hospitals would receive in Alaska about $561 million over several years.
Hospitals make the case for expanding Medicaid in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 27th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Governor Parnell pledges funding to figure out why king salmon populations are declining.
The $10 million is a down payment on $30 million across the next 5 years to address these gaps in our knowledge of our fish.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC. President Barack Obama has issued a disaster declaration for large parts of Alaska affected by storms, winds, flooding, and landslides during September. The White House, in a release today, announced the declaration, which allows federal aid to supplement state and local recovery efforts. Officials say federal funding is available to the state, local governments, and some nonprofit organizations on a cost-sharing basis for emergency work and the repair or replacement of damaged facilities. The declaration covers the Tok and Chugach rural education attendance areas and the Denali, Kenai Peninsula, and Matanuska-Susitna boroughs. A coalition of health care providers and advocates in the state is pushing Governor Sean Parnell to expand Alaska's Medicaid rolls under the Affordable Care Act. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, tens of thousands of Alaskans could qualify for Medicaid if Governor Parnell chooses to open the rolls, and many medical providers could stand to make millions of dollars.
The Supreme Court largely left the Affordable Care Act intact over the summer, though it struck down a key provision forcing states to swell the ranks of Medicaid recipients. Governor Parnell is withholding his decision on whether to expand Medicaid until he gets results from a cost analysis. A few months ago, he indicated to APRN he's erring towards no.
If I had to make the decision today, I would not expand Medicaid for concern over costs and the uncertain future of Medicaid on the federal side.
The federal government pays about half the state's $1.2 billion Medicaid tab, and Alaska picks up the rest. But the Obama administration is offering a much better deal for the Medicaid expansion. It will pay 100% of the expansion in years 2014, 15, and 16. Karen Perdue is the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, a group that wants Governor Parnell to expand the Medicaid rolls. Perdue says medical providers in Alaska could stand to make hundreds of millions of dollars more over the next decade.
The hospitals would receive about $561 million over several years in revenue that probably would not come in the door.
Revenue that would not come in the door if the governor opts to not expand the Medicaid ranks. The number she uses comes from a new Kaiser Family Foundation study released this week. Purdue says hospitals need the expansion and extra revenue because under the Affordable Care Act, providers in Alaska could lose up to $25 million per year in Medicare reimbursements.
Alaska hospitals, most of which are small community hospitals, municipal hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, would really be impacted by the Medicare reductions.
Ann Seacrest is with AARP Alaska. Her take on the expansion.
It needs to happen. It just makes sense.
AARP tends to pick its fights over Social Security and Medicare. But Seacrest says AARP members are not uniform, and an expansion to Medicaid could directly affect them.
Many of our members are still working. Many of them are under 65. We have a lot of our members who are what we call dual eligible.
Dual eligible, meaning able to qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid. The group AK Health Reform estimates that more than 32,000 new people, mostly childless adults, could become eligible for Medicaid under the expansion. Delisa Culpepper is the chief operating officer at the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Her group funds mental health providers in the state. And though the authority has not taken an official position on the expansion, she says she's excited about Medicaid potentially insuring people who have not qualified before.
Medicaid is a medical model. It makes people have to meet a certain threshold of mental illness in order to get any services, as well as income. And because of that, there are a lot of people that don't fit in and aren't eligible for Medicaid because only certain populations are.
Under the expansion, the roles would be open to people making less than $18,500 per year. And Culpepper says right now the state largely restricts eligibility to the elderly, mothers, and pregnant women. Because of that, she says, people are being left out.
Medicaid doesn't always fund, especially for the adult population, treatment for substance abuse and alcohol.
There is no deadline for the governor to decide whether to expand Medicaid, but the 100% federal contribution is only good for the first 3 years of the program. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Governor Parnell visited Kenai on Wednesday to meet with local officials, mingle with residents, and make a $30 million announcement. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, that's the amount the governor is proposing to spend on a five-year Chinook salmon research initiative.
I am proposing that we fund $10 million of research on Chinook salmon across this state, including the Kenai and Upper Cook Inlet area.
That's the news that greeted a room filled mostly with fishermen from Governor Sean Parnell at the Kenai Cultural and Visitor Center. He made it around the room to hear what was on people's minds, and mostly it was fishing. Megan Smith is an Eastside Set netter and spoke with the governor prior to his announcement.
We just want him to realize how important reds are to the community and how important reds are to the state, that next summer, hopefully we can move forward and work for a solution to let everyone harvest and everyone have a piece of the pie, because there's plenty for everyone.
Amber Every and Linda Gabriel are also set netters, and we're pleased that the governor is tuned into the concerns of the fishing industry on the Kenai Peninsula.
He just let us know that there was a $10 million budget appropriation for research, and that's important moving forward. We need to figure out what's happening to these king salmon. Is there a conservation concern, and if so, how we're going to deal with it?
That research plan is the product of a two-day salmon symposium held in Anchorage in October, when scientists, fisheries managers, and fishermen from across the state pitched in ideas about the kinds of information they were interested in gathering and what a research plan would include.
Like, what happens to our young salmon in that first year, both in freshwater and in the marine life, the marine world? So the $10 million is a down payment on $30 million across the next 5 years that will be made to address these gaps in our knowledge of our fish.
The research will include adult, juvenile, and harvest assessments, plus genetics and biometrics, all taken into account with what makes up the local knowledge base of these fisheries. The $10 million used to get the program started this year is in addition to the $14.6 million the Department of Fish and Game already spends annually on Chinook research and management. The governor offered his pledge that regardless of the causes for poor king salmon returns that forced both sport and commercial fishery closures this summer. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Representative Bill Thomas said today he's 99.9% sure he will request a recount in the House District 34 race. Thomas of Haines lost re-election by 34 votes to Sitka Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins. Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai certified the race on Friday. She said Thomas has until the end of the day tomorrow to file a request for a state-funded recount. A recount will be conducted Thursday in another close legislative race. Republican challenger Bob Bell sought the recount after losing to Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, by 51 votes in the general election. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Coast Guard ship visits the most remote island in Alaska.
When I got assigned to the Attu, it had occurred to me to do some study and figure out what the heck she was named after. I'd never heard of Attu Island.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
More than half the women in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have experienced partner violence or sexual violence within their lifetime. That's according to a new study led by the state. Angela Denning-Barnes reports from KYUK in Bethel.
The survey interviewed 514 adult women in the YK Delta. It found that 51% had experienced intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both at some point in their life. It also found that 17% had experienced this kind of violence within the past year. 17% is equivalent to
more than 1,200 women.
Andre Rosé is with the University of Alaska's Justice Center, which conducted the survey between March and May. Rosé says learning the differences between violence in the past year versus a lifetime can help the state direct proper services.
The lifetime numbers may indicate some historical trauma that needs to be addressed.
Lori Martin wasn't surprised by the numbers, but that's because she's worked with victims for many years through the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
I think if you've not experienced working with women as they come forward, it's shocking. You don't want to think that the numbers are as high as they are.
Survey backers say the estimates are conservative, possibly very conservative in some regions. The survey only included women who had access to a phone line in an environment where they felt they could talk freely for about a half an hour. Rosé says it did not include women living in shelters, hospitals, or prison, and it was only in English.
We also know that the estimates are conservative because of the continuing stigma that's associated with disclosing intimate partner violence and sexual violence, particularly to a stranger on the phone. That's a very difficult thing to do.
Still, the survey gives the state a broad baseline of data about victims, something they never had before.
One of the problems that we've had in the past is that everything that we used to know about domestic violence and sexual violence was based on law enforcement reports.
We kept getting asked that particular question, which was, what's our rate of victimization? And we would say, we don't know.
Katie Tipas works with the governor's office. She says now they know exactly what they're up against.
What we can emphatically state is that across the state, our rates are way too high. We have horrific rates, so it doesn't matter where people are residing, they're horrific. And so as a state, all of us have to do something.
Statewide, the Alaska Victimization Survey interviewed 871 adult women. It found that 59% have experienced intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both at some point in their lifetime. About 12% had within the past year. The whole project started in 2010 with plans to survey all regions of the state. The goal is for the survey to be repeated every 5 years. Again, Lori Morton.
While the lifetime numbers probably won't change, we're hoping that maybe the previous year numbers will see an adjustment.
Locally, the survey was well received. Michelle DeWitt has directed the Tender Women's Coalition, a regional women's shelter in Bethel, for 15 years. She was impressed that over 500 women felt comfortable enough to talk about the abuse over the phone to a stranger.
The fact that so many of the individuals completed the entire interview, which was about 30 minutes, and I think that, you know, a lot of that has to do with all of the work that's been done for many, many years across the Delta to make an impact on issues related to domestic violence and sexual assault.
DeWitt believes over the past few decades, there has been an attitude shift in the YK Delta about domestic violence and sexual assault that's making it easier for people to seek shelter and services.
Because we've created an environment in the region where people are much more willing to discuss issues around domestic violence or sexual abuse, we may have a group of people who are more likely to engage in the research, to speak with the researchers, to request services, to disclose and to report abuse.
As for how Alaska's rates compare nationally, that's still unknown. But Rosé with the UAA Justice Center says they are working on those details. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
A report out yesterday from the United Nations Environment Program urges policymakers and the general public to account for potential hazards of thawing permafrost. One UAF scientist co-authored the report. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Several reports on risks associated with thawing permafrost and climate change have been published by the United Nations Environment Program over the last 5 years. But University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Vladimir Romanovsky says none of them are as unique as one released this week.
The target of this report is politicians, public. So this report was a challenge because we had to write in very simple words, and we don't accustomed to do it as a scientist.
Romanovsky studies permafrost geophysics all over the world. Permafrost is land that remains frozen for at least 2 years. Roughly a quarter of the land surface in the Northern Hemisphere includes permafrost. In the report, Romanovsky and other scientists recommend that nations with permafrost, including the United States, Canada, and Russia, set up monitoring networks and develop plans to deal with thaw.
Lots of infrastructure is already exist in permafrost regions, but it's developing very, very rapidly. There is another regional concerns or how changes in permafrost will affect the environment and ecosystems. And there is many concerns related to subsistence hunting, species distribution, all kind of things which are point of worries for the people who live there.
Permafrost is rich in frozen organic matter. According to the report, that organic matter holds 1,700 gigatons of carbon. 1 gigaton equals 1 billion tons. Scientists estimate that air temperatures in the Arctic could increase by up to 6 degrees over the next century. If the permafrost starts to thaw because of the warming trend, all that organic matter will start to decompose. Decomposition could mean the release of hundreds of gigatons of two major greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane. Romanovsky believes that nearly 50% of the world's permafrost could be thawing by the year 2100. Unfortunately, he says, unless you live this far north, it's an unfamiliar problem.
So for the most of the global community, permafrost is something very often very exotic, you know, somewhere there in the north. It's just, you know, small piece.
The report comes as industrialized nations consider a replacement for the 1997 Kyoto Protocol. The international agreement sets binding targets for greenhouse gas emissions among 37 nations and the European Union. But that doesn't include the United States. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at FNBAlaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
What's it look like inside an octopus? You probably don't want to know, at least firsthand. That's unless you're a student dissecting one during this month's Sitka Whale Fest. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
So what we're going to do is we're going to pass out some of these octopus. We've got enough to do an octopus for two or three people.
Marine biologist Reed Brewer hands out trays, each holding a small octopus, to students at the state-run Mount Edgecombe Boarding High School in Sitka. The students from around the state are about to take them apart.
Medium, large, medium. For dissection etiquette, don't touch people with slimy hands. I would recommend against fixing your hairs after we started.
Some greet the slimy mollusk's arrival with disgust, then curiosity, and a little giggling. Brewer holds up a larger specimen, and the interactive lesson begins.
So octopus have 8 legs, right?
8 arms.
It's a test. It's a test. All right, they have 8 arms. Each of the arms is covered with 230 to 280 sucker discs. Okay, so again, I said this octopus could probably hold around 4,000, 5,000 pounds using these sucker discs.
Brewer is usually based in Unalaska, working as an agent for the State Marine Advisory Program. But this particular week, he's teaching students at Edgecombe and other classrooms as part of the Sitka Whale Fest Science in the School's program.
Okay, so I want you to look at the center part. So lift up your legs where all the legs come together underneath it, and you should find a black parrot-like beak. All right? It's right in the middle.
The students become focused as they locate, then remove the beaks. With Brewer's instructions and program volunteers' encouragement, they start searching for and examining a variety of organs. A few miles away, middle school students are learning how seals regulate body temperature by dipping their faces into cold water, and high schoolers are being briefed about marine acoustics.
We're trying to bring in scientists that have sort of cutting-edge ideas and are good at working with students.
Steve Lewis of Tenneke coordinates the science in the school's program.
Part of my role is, as an educator and a scientist, to try to bridge that gap and help some of the scientists figure out some of the tricks to really integrating and making kids remember what they've talked about and drawing them into the system.
Back in the classroom, Brewer instructs students as they cut into the octopus's mantle, looking for internal organs.
Turn it so the eyes are facing down, and there's a little slit back here. I want you to cut this little slit, okay?
This is the fourth necropsy for Kate Wilmarth from Red Devil, Brittany Woods Orison from Rampart, and Natasha Kukesh from Angoon.
We started with a
crayfish.
Crayfish.
And then we went to a
frog.
And then a rat.
Yeah. The rat was really gross.
So what's your favorite so far?
I think this one's
Yeah, this one's the coolest one so far.
Yeah.
Octopus sessions were offered to more than a dozen classes hosted by WhaleFest Science in the school's program. It also organized another 60 sessions on other marine topics. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Sitka.
Alaska's westernmost point is actually in the eastern hemisphere. Attu Island is the last in the Aleutian chain and closer to Russia than Alaska's mainland. The fog and shrouded island doesn't get many visitors, but earlier this month, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Sherman and some of her crew, each with their own unique tie to Attu, visited. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
The Japanese invaded Attu as well as Kiska Island in June 1942. Both were highly contested in World War II because of their location. The U.S. military feared Attu would become a staging ground for attacks on North America. In 1943, American soldiers recaptured the island, turning it into a staging ground for attacks on Japan. 70 years later, the 378-foot Coast Guard cutter Sherman glided into Massacre Bay as dawn was slowly breaking through the fog and gloom. Attu Island has a number of grim-sounding places. Massacre Bay most likely gets its name from the murder of 15 Aleuts in 1745 by Russians. For Sherman Commanding Officer Captain Joe Hester, the trip to Attu was a link to his first years in the Coast Guard when he was assigned to the cutter Attu 20 years ago.
It was a patrol boat of the island class, 110 feet long, crew of 17.
Hester served on the cutter Attu twice, in Puerto Rico.
When I got assigned to the Attu, it had occurred to me to do some study and figure out what the heck she was named after. I'd never heard of Attu Island.
Attu and San Juan are more than 5,200 nautical miles apart. Hester did that study.
And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be interesting someday, serving down here in the southeastern corner of our country in Puerto Rico, on board the cutter Attu, to someday get to the northwestern corner of our country and see this desolate island named Attu.
Four others on the Sherman had personal connections to the island. Two had worked at the Loran station before the Coast Guard shut it down. The abandoned long-range aids to navigation station sits white atop a wide brown bluff with Mount Terrible in the background. When the men stepped ashore, Hester says, the two told him they thought they'd never see the place again.
On that desolate island, there's really only the Coast Guard Loran station with 22 people on it, which for those 6 weeks included these two, and they didn't remember each other.
One of the five Sherman crew to visit Attu had worked at several remote Loran stations and always wanted to go to the one at Attu. It closed before he got a chance. As the five were on the island, the Coast Guard C-130 aircraft circled overhead, dropping parts to the Sherman. When the Loran station was open, the plane was among the few connections to the outside world. Weather permitting, it came once every other week. Weather often did not permit. That was not lost on Boatswain's Mate Chief Shane Milot, a retired Navy man turned Coast Guard. The day was cold, and so was he, despite the high-tech Gore-Tex thick boots and other modern gear he wore.
I was just thinking about how cold we are in the gear that we've got today, and I know those guys usually went out without the type of gear that we're using, so I'm sure they were just freezing all the time and trying to do what they had to do before getting back in to try and warm up a little bit.
Milot's grandfather, from Oklahoma, was a heavy equipment operator on Attu during the war. He didn't talk much about the experience until his grandson announced he had joined the Navy.
My grandfather said that when he was in the Corps of Engineers, World War II, he was up here building bases. And basically, he and his team got invited along to go run the Japs out of the Aleutian Islands. And while I don't think he was in the primary wave that hit Attu, I know he was on Attu. And he also went to Kiska.
Milot calls Attu Island desolate but gorgeous. And now it has special significance to him. Captain Hester says it was his idea to visit Attu during the Sherman's Fall Bering Sea Patrol. He describes trenches, abandoned fuel tanks, and a few memorials as standing in silent witness to the courage and sacrifice of those who fought to reclaim the island for the U.S. He notes the five crewmen's reaction, including BMC Milot.
He walked the beaches and saw the piers and saw the places where his grandpa had served about 70 years ago, and it meant something to me, and I think it meant a lot to the chief.
As the men departed Attu, Hester says a snowy owl landed atop a cement door frame, standing alone amidst the rubble of a World War II building in the tundra.
The owl never deigned to even take a look at us, only over its shoulder, possibly contemplating the large white Coast Guard cutter in the bay from which we'd come and to which we would soon return.
Leaving the barren, quiet place to the owl and the geese, to the abandoned wreckage of war and fishermen long gone, and to the ghosts and memories that haunt Attu. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had help tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.